And let's open a public, or let's open a work session on Senate Bill 348. We did have a couple people that were slated to testify. Let's start with Stephen Cafori.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Cafori. I'm here today representing the Oregon chapter of the American Planning Association. We represent planning members of the community, both in the private sector and in the public sector, those who represent the development and interests. So we represent both sides of the desk, so to speak. I appreciate the courtesy the chair has shown allowing me to testify today. I was unable to testify here the day when you had the hearing on the bill, and I appreciate the indulgence of the committee as well. I'll be very brief. I understand that this bill is scheduled to go out, and but before it does, I'd just like to say that our organization strongly opposes the bill. We think it's an embarrassment. We think it's, first of all, an embarrassment to those folks who drafted and passed Bill Measure 37. What it says is that the poster child for that measure can't get relief under the bill, and so they have to pass a special bill in order to do that. It seems to me if they spent less money on advertising and more money on lawyers drafting the bill, it wouldn't have been in such a mess as they're in now. Secondly, I think it's an embarrassment to those who feel that democracy means equal opportunity. Our system, as I understand it, is set up that all citizens have the same rights and fall under the same laws, and we don't pass special legislation giving individuals benefits that we don't give other individuals. If we think that what's in this bill is good policy, then it should be applied across the board to all citizens who find themselves in similar circumstances, rather than passing a bill that's so narrowly drafted it applies only to one person. And thirdly, I think it's being an embarrassment to the legislature. I think what will likely happen after this bill passes, there are right now in the neighborhood of 200 claimants around the state, a large number of whom are going to find out that, just like Dorothy English, what they wanted to have from ballot measure 37 is not going to happen, that the way the bill is drafted, it doesn't help them. And I think you're going to find a lot of people coming in and say, why does this one person get a benefit and I don't? Why don't you pass this bill, a special bill, benefiting me as well? I would oppose these two bills and would hope that this body would not pass them.
Okay. Any questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Ron Eber and Bob Brindy, please. Go ahead and identify yourselves for the record, please.
My name is Ron Eber. I'm the Farm and Forest Land Specialist for the Department of Land Conservation and Development.
Okay. And I'm Bob Rindy. I'm Legislative Coordinator for the Department.
Okay. Thank you for coming today. I asked you to come just to clarify a couple questions before the committee. First of all, could you explain to the committee your understanding of the Attorney General's opinion on whether Measure 37 rights are transferable?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I can do that. As far as I know, there's nothing formal in writing. What I have been told by the director is that it is the Attorney General's or the Department of Justice's opinion that waivers that may be granted under Measure 37 are not transferable. And that is what we have been instructed to say when we get questions from citizens over the telephone, and I pass that on in several instances.
And is that something that you have told citizens that have contacted your office?
Chair Ringo, that's correct.
And I know that you're not an expert on the application on a certain parcel in western Multnomah County, but based on what you do know, how might that impact that parcel?
Chair Ringo, members of the committee, and I am one of the people at the department who is working on evaluating Measure 37 claims, so I've been trying to keep up with what it may mean or not mean as best as possible. As I understand it, if there are land use restrictions in place that do not allow the use of a particular piece of property, and that leads to a reduction in the fair market value of that property, then the government either has a choice to compensate for that reduction in fair market value or to, we use the term, waive the regulation that restricts that use. My understanding is that if the waiver is granted, for a particular piece of ground, which may allow it to be sold or it to be divided, and dwellings to be built on it, that upon the sale of that parcel, it's not transferable, because the way the measure is written, it talks about waiving back to what the current owner could do. And that's the position we've been given.
So just to put things in context, if the owner of the property, Dorothy English, wanted to subdivide, Measure 37 would not allow her, at least under this interpretation, to sell the land to a developer to go forward with a subdivision, because that developer doesn't receive her rights under Measure 37.
Chair Ringo, that's my understanding.
Okay. Would you like to add anything, Mr.
Ringo? I want to clarify a couple of things. And first of all, the department doesn't have a position on this bill.
Okay.
And second of all, that as far as we know, there is no written opinion from the Department of Justice or formal Attorney General's opinion or something of that nature. So we are, in some respect, just reporting on what we've heard. And so I can't tell you the reasoning or the whatever is behind this opinion.
But that's the analysis that at least you convey to other people who contact your office.
Correct, and that's what we've been asked to do. With respect to the sale or transfer of those rights, of course, if the Dorothy English claim goes through and she is able to subdivide that property, she may sell those lots to other people. The question is whether the new people who acquire them are able to build or not. If she's already built the house, then of course that may be somewhat of a moot question, although it has been put forth, and I don't know the full legal answer of this. It's been stated that they might be a non-conforming use.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Okay. Thank you very much. Any discussion from the committee in general on Senate Bill 348?
Mr. Chair, I assume all of you got this information from, I guess it was from Multnomah County. I'd asked a question about whether or not there's any other parcels that are affected by this bill.
You're waving an email at me, and I think I read the same email, at least one that raised some possibilities. It didn't give it
somewhere between 0 and 36 or 1,600 tax lots may be affected by this bill.
Dave Honeycutt, could you come up and just address that point for a minute, please? Sorry for surprising you and dragging you up from the very back. Senator Beyer, could you just relay to Mr. Honeycutt what that says?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I asked a question last hearing about the other potential lots impacted by the bill. And the response back from Multnomah County is that they did a title search. It's incomplete, and they don't know exactly because, for instance, Dorothy English's lot shows a recorded deed of 1994 but does not show 1955 date, so they're not sure the status of that lot. But there could be they think 36 lots that could be affected, but it could be as high as 1,600 lots.
Can you speak to that, Mr. Honeycutt?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I believe it was last session when this bill came out, the county's position at that time was that there could be as many as 5 lots. And so I don't, the bill applies so to a very narrow and specified set of circumstances. If you go through the bill and go through all the different requirements that one would have to meet in order to obtain a right under the measure, I have a hard time seeing that it's... I had a hard time believing that there were 5, but to go beyond that, I think it's questionable.
Just a question for you, Mr. Honeycutt. If upon closer review, and I think this is a huge if, because my understanding is it's so narrowly tailored that it's not likely to apply to anybody else, but if it's found to apply to somebody else, would you agree to help us work with amendments on the other side to narrow it even further?
Chair Ringo, absolutely.
Yeah, thank you. Any other discussions from the... Okay. I'll just make a comment. I, perhaps to Mr. Kefouri, I think in general it is not good policy for this legislature to do, quote, special interest legislation or to legislate with regard to a single property owner. But I also don't think we should be completely inflexible. If we see a circumstance where we have an opportunity to do the right thing, I think we should do the right thing. Some people say, well, why don't you fix all of Measure 37 rather than just address this? Well, there's a lot of disagreement about what it means to fix Measure 37. Some people would fix Measure 37 in a way that would facilitate paving Hood River Valley and facilitate development all up and down the Willamette Valley, and I don't know if we'll get to that, but the thing I do believe is that when voters voted yes on Measure 37, they did intend that one person who lives in Multnomah County, who's about 92 years old, would be able to subdivide. And I think it is doing the right thing. It is ironic that we have to do this because, in my opinion, Measure 37 is so fundamentally flawed that it's not even allowing its chief petitioner to carry out her intentions. And I hope that message goes out to people who say, don't touch a word of Measure 37. I get a lot of emails and phone calls from people who say, don't touch a single word of Measure 37. It's exactly what the voters intended. And I just absolutely reject that view because the fact is Measure 37 is so defective that even its chief petitioner isn't able to achieve its purpose. So those are all my comments. Any other comments? Okay.
Senator Ringo, I didn't know whether you have this bill before us to vote on right away or where we are. I was out of the room for
just a moment. I'm sorry, Senator Shields. It is my intention to go ahead and vote it out.
Okay. A lot of us have a lot of questions about the bill, and I understand your rationale for bringing it this afternoon in front of us. And I guess I don't need to talk too much because I would be kind of reiterating a lot of what you've just got through saying. I think we need to demonstrate that we are listening to Oregonians. At the same time, I think that we do know that the measure has a lot of significant flaws, and I both have to recognize that last session I didn't vote for this bill. You know, I was against it because I think it sets a bad precedent. And anybody that thinks that I'm going to vote for numerous bills of this type would be wrong, because I won't. But I think, in a real sense, that if even Dorothy English, who was kind of the inspiration behind the measure, can't still do what she wants to do with her land, then you've got a serious flaw in the measure itself. And on that basis alone, I would think that this sends a signal that you need to do some serious work on ballot measure 37. I don't want to get rid of the land use system in Oregon. I really don't. I know that sometimes it seems unfair, but I think we should be taking a look at Measure 37 and thinking about what it says to the voters of Oregon. Anyway, I just wanted to share a few of my thoughts with you.
Thank you, Senator Shields. Senator Atkinson?
Absolutely. I don't think that the flaw is Measure 37, just to add another point of view. I think the flaw is the immense bureaucratic red tape and bring me another rock part of doing something with your land in this state. Somewhere between a city, a county, an LCDC, someone has got to spend more time, more money, and more lawyer bills to get common sense, or at least what they thought they were going to be able to do with their land, able to get through. The fact of the matter is it's somewhere between the department and all of this great speech that we make up here in Salem, real people don't know where to get answers. Mm-hmm. And so is Measure 37 largely a frustration? Perhaps. But one of the problems I'm dealing with right now, and some of the problems I'm dealing with in my district, are people who can't get a straight answer. Somewhere between the department, and somewhere between a field person, and somewhere between the city, and somewhere between the county, nobody knows what they could do. Please stay there and pay taxes, but they don't have a property right. or they thought they had a property right, but they don't have a property right. They want to protect farm use, but they don't necessarily can make any money with the farmland. So I'm happy to support this bill. I don't know what kind of precedent it does send. I wish the only remedy that someone like Dorothy English doesn't have is to wait through the legislature for four years before they can get some relief from something that costs too much to work in. So, you know, it's a different point of view. I'm glad we're going to move this bill, but the problem is there's a lot of other people out there like Dorothy English that can't afford the lawyers and can't afford the headache of dealing with the bureaucracy that we set up.
Senator Atkinson, when I was looking your direction, I was really expecting a motion instead of a speech.
I'll give you that, too.
Could you have a motion on this bill?
I'll move the bill, Mr. Chair.
To the floor with a do-pass recommendation?
As you wish.
Okay. Thank you. Kate, if you could call the roll and if you could go get our Senator Beyer, that would be great.
I think there's a room for discussion between his... making the motion and us voting, is there not?
Oh, was there any further discussion on Senator Atkinson's motion?
I was just wanting to respond to the good senator that I liked his speech more than his motion.
Okay.
I do hear his speech, and I understand the frustration of Oregonians all over the place.
Okay.
We have got to figure out a way to do this without destroying land use totally. This is a signal of our seriousness. That's what I would say about this afternoon.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Shields. Okay, could you go ahead and call the roll?
Byers?
What are we voting on?
Senate Bill 348.
Aye.
Curtis? Shields?
Aye.
Atkinson?
Aye.
Chair
Vito? Aye. Senate Bill 348 passes to the House, to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation. And then let's open a public hearing on Senate Bill 64. And we have Tim Wood and Louis Pitt, and what if you could come up together, that'd be great.
You can carry them. What's that? You carry them?
I'll carry them. I don't. Thank you for coming and go ahead. I need to step out for 1 second.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tim Wood. I'm the director of the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department, and I'm here asking for your support for Senate Bill 64. Senate Bill 64 would provide technical corrections to two state statutes that were originally amended in 1993. I also have with me James Hamrick, our Deputy State Historic Preservation Officer, who can assist in answering questions if we need to later on. Two things need to be corrected in the archaeological statutes. The first relates to the compensation clause in ORS 358.953. The legislative intent when this clause was first enacted in 1993 was that private property owners would be eligible for compensation if an archaeological permit was denied or unacceptable conditions were placed on the commit or placed on the permit by the department. Permits are required for archaeological excavations on both public and private lands in Oregon. And Oregon tribes also have veto power over archaeological permits. It was felt at the time that there needed to be the potential for compensation, since a veto by a tribe of a permit application on private lands could either stop a proposed development or a property owner might have to accrue expenses during a mediation or an arbitration that's required under the statute 390.240 if there is any dispute that occurs over issuance of the permit. Our request for a revision relates specifically as a result of the fact that the department or the state was sued using the compensation clause, even though no archaeological permit had been requested. This suit has been ongoing for almost 10 years with the substantial consequent legal costs. The proposed new language in ORS 358.953 would make it clear that compensation can only be requested relative to the archaeological permit process, such as a permit denial or unacceptable conditions of approval. The second technical correction deals solely with conforming the two statutes, 390.235(1)(a) to the existing language and 358.921(a). This correction should have been made when the statute was amended in 1993. And so these changes in no way have any effect on the existing legal requirement relating to archaeological statutes. Rather, it would just serve to end years of confusion over the conflicting language in the two statutes. Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have, and thank you for the opportunity to make this presentation.
Thank you.
Quick question. Tell me what happens if somebody, if a farmer tilling their ground finds something, I don't know, a shard of a piece of pottery or something. What is there some kind of protection for that farmer? Does farming stop until we go through a new permit process?
Mr. Chair, Senator Atkinson, if I could ask Mr. Hamrick to assist. He's a technical expert on the statute.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, James Hamrick. I'm Assistant Director at Parks, and I manage the State Historic Preservation Office and the archaeological permit process. Mr. Chair, Senator Atkinson, it is not illegal for someone tilling the ground. Basically, if they run into an artifact, there's nothing prohibiting them picking it up. One of the things about determining whether or not something is an archaeological artifact, essentially, if it's been removed from its context, in other words, it's been plowed up and it's just sort of lying there, doesn't have any sort of relational context anymore. It's just a piece, and it may be broken. It may be historic, say, from a settlement era period. In other words, is it 75 years of age or older, then it's not illegal. The statute does say that you can, in fact, take possession of an artifact without it, without breaking law. To answer your question.
Why do we, well, other than these statutory changes, then what kind of protections does that person have to continue on with what they were doing?
The archaeological statutes relating to the permit statutes on private land and public and private land relate to disturbance of what is considered to be an archaeological site. So, for instance, if the farmer is plowing the field and runs across human burials, for instance, then there, or it could be, say, a village site, then, in essence, the farmer needs to stop and call the state police, et cetera, and then deal with that. But it's not in every instance are you going to either have something that qualifies as an archaeological artifact or an archaeological site.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess you're going to have to walk me through your presentation again where you started, Mr. Woods, because there's nowhere in current statute I can see where it applies to private land, yet you're saying that it does. And it seems, I mean, the way I read this is that you are adding private land to this.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Beyer, if you, ORS 358920, basically, it's entitled Prohibited Conduct. That's the section in the 1993 law which makes it illegal. And I will just read it. A person may not excavate, injure, destroy, or alter an archaeological site or object, or remove an archaeological object located on public or private lands in Oregon unless that activity is authorized by a permit issued under ORS 390235.
What was that statutory reference again, please?
It's ORS 358920, sub 1A.
You got the book.
Got the book. Mr. Chairman, Senator Beyer, I have a copy of it here if you'd like to look at it.
Sure. You got copies for all of us?
You have more than one copy.
Not 920, you said sub 1, sub A?
Correct.
Is it exactly right, Senator Beyer. It says a person may not excavate, inure, destroy, or alter an archaeological site or object, or remove an archaeological object located on public or private lands in Oregon unless that activity is authorized by a permit issued under ORS 390.235. If I could just follow up with a question, without understanding the whole statutory scheme, why, if that's the case, why is it that currently 358.945 only mentions public?
Mr. Chairman, because the when the session ended, the statutes were not conformed.
I see.
That's the really simple. It's actually a technical correction.
I see. Did we hear from you, Mr. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'm thinking about Senator Atkinson's comment. He's talking about a farmer plowing his field, turns up an artifact, does he have to stop, does it mess up his farming operation? I'm assuming the farmer doesn't have to stop at all. He's plowing his field. It could be a Coke bottle from the 50s that he just plowed up or something. You know, is that true?
Mr. Chairman,
you described another extreme, which would be all of a sudden plowing up human bones, which is not very likely in a wheat field or a cornfield or something, you know.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Shields, OPRD actually owns land that it leases out to people who do farm, say, for instance, in Shampooey, which, as you know, was flooded and destroyed several times. Those people blading those fields actually do turn up artifacts all the time. But they are not considered to be an archaeological site. The department has done archaeological digs on the Shampooey town site for years as an organized sort of a thing through the university, Oregon State University. But no, the a farmer would not have to basically stop unless they ran into things that are considered to be funerary objects, sacred objects, things that actually are covered under the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, that the substance of which is actually in this the general archaeological statute.
Why don't we hear from Mr. Pitt?
Yeah, thank you, Chairman. For the record, my name is Louis Pitt, Jr., Yowen Schricht, Warm Springs Confederated Tribes, Director of Government Affairs and Planning. We are in support of the follow-through on Senate Bill 64. We worked, one of the rare times you had, a great team effort back in the day, back in 93 and 95, where we worked a number of tribes. We had 7 out of 9 tribes working towards higher protections of cultural resources in Oregon, and it was Ken Baker at that time, from the Klamath area, that made sure that we got, the full package in there and put the private language in there, and said to some of the staff that we should be fired if we're not going for the whole works to protect the cultural resources as they are. And for us as a tribal group is that we're, as tribes, we within this big interaction of us in the United States and citizens of the state of Oregon and all that, is that we feel that we've never given up in those negotiations our connection to definitely our dead, and that we have very strong connections to the sites. And I think the state of Oregon has been very gracious in changing in growth the words ownership of cultural resources Oregon to stewardship. It always leaves that challenge of, as you're talking about that farmer, is that we're always trying to educate folks about areas that we suspect may be real conducive to maybe a site or two, and then try to educate these folks as to what it is. And we have we've had farmers voluntarily stop and get a hold of us and try to ascertain, because they want to do what's right, and the law certainly does help that. once again, is that there's been a, I think, just recently a lot of press on the by the federal agencies that serve search warrants. And for us, Indian country, it's always been a struggle to try to get some of our sites off reservation, protected, and education is probably the key part. And one of the main parts is trying to educate landowners not only about the law, but what more can they do to help protect within the law and work with the appropriate tribes of that area to get the best protection of the resources. And again, this is follow through. And although the word private's right out there in front, is that that was something included way back when. And as the technical amendments go, they do make it a conforming and more clarified package that we need to better protect state's resources and tribal resources in Oregon.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any questions from the committee? Committee, to me it sounds like a good bill and one we ought to move forward, but I'm not sure you're there yet, and I'd like some indication. Do you want to sit on this for take some time and read it, Senator Beyer? Or?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would appreciate that.
Okay.
I'm still trying to figure out how this all fits together.
Okay.
And it's, if you look at the 358.920, it says that first it's what is it, you know, violation or whatever the word is, if you disturb or remove things from an archaeological site, collection of an arrowhead from the surface of public or private land is permitted if the collection can be accomplished without a tool. But then in the next section it says the prima facie evidence of a violation of this section if a person possesses the object described in paragraph A. So it says in paragraph A you can't, it says in paragraph B you can, it says in paragraph C if you have anything you collected in paragraph B, it's a violation of paragraph A. That's the way I read it, and I don't know how a lawyer, but it seems to me like it's a little confusing.
Well, I suggest you work with Senator Beyer in allaying his concerns, and we'll bring this up in a week or so when you've had a chance to do that, okay?
Before you close, I just want to say that I appreciate what Senator Beyer is saying. I don't share his concerns. I've talked to several ranchers, for instance, out around Madras that have collected an awful lot of arrowheads and so on over the years, and some of them are state employees. You know, as farmers, they've also done work with the state and seem to understand it pretty well. So I don't have those concerns. I just hope you do bring it back, Mr. Chair, for your work.
I expect to. But thank you very much, and let's close the public hearing on Senate Bill 364. And I'd like to tell the folks in the committee. I'm sorry, did you want to testify on this?
Yeah.
I'm sorry about that. Well, I closed the public hearing, but come on up and testify anyway. We'd be glad to hear you. I'm not sure. I'm sorry. I didn't have you on my list here, or your name had been. What?
Ed Johnston.
Oh, I'm sorry. We had your name on your list, and then it was crossed off for some reason.
I don't know who crossed it off. It wasn't me. Thank you. My name is Ed Johnston, the Lincoln County Political Action Committee. I'd like to read this. Senate Bill 64. Trespass for a good cause is still trespass. Once upon a time in the Wild West, the government conspired with the white folks who didn't own land to take land away from the red folks, Native Americans who did not. Now, this bill would, in certain circumstances, reverse the takings. The first was a crime against a Native American. This bill is a small scale, not much better in reverse. Under existing law, a person who is conducting an archaeological investigation had to do either with a permit or on public lands or else on private lands. And if on private lands with the owner's written permission. Senate Bill 64 changes that. It does three things. It removes the requirement for written permission from the private landowner. It gives the state the authority to issue permits for access to and shall, we say, trespass on private property for archaeological purposes, and force the State Department of Parks and Rec to pay for the consequences, only for those consequences including a denial of a permit, consequent inability of the landowner to encourage in certain specific conduct of his land. We understand that the permit process will still be a public process, and one where the landowner may come and make a case against the permit, But this bill still transfers the right of decision of who shall trespass on private property. The archaeological matters from this private sapphire to the public domain. This is surely for good scientific and tribal purposes. But what about the harm to the landowner for the trespass? And what about the harms or losses they might arise due to the state sanctions of trespassing? The bill would allow the trespass, shields the permit, archaeological or tribe from ordinary legal consequences of the trespassing. This restricts the circumstances where the property owner can compensate for their harm or loss. Why shouldn't the tribe or the archaeological ask the landowner for permission to enter the property or perhaps pay for the right? As the land stands now, what is so wrong with that? The archaeological is a good thing, and respect for the tribe's right, heritage, and remains is good, too. But currently, the market decides when and where archaeological or tribe may enter private property for archaeological and tribe purposes. Yes, we know that the land once upon a time all belonged to the Native Americans. We are now paying them back in part for the theft by allowing tribes' casinos policing willing gamblers of the contents of their pocket. Surely some degree of justice is being done through these devices, but it is not being done upon unwilling parties who have no volunteering for the policing. Currently, landowners are not the ones who did the crimes against Native Americans a century or so ago. It has seemed unwarranted to authorize the state new crimes against those innocent landowners.
Mr. Johnson, thank you very much. You don't have a copy of your testimony, do you?
Yes, I will definitely make sure you have a copy of that.
That's fine, and make it available to the committee administrator. That would be fine. Well, we already closed the public hearing. If you could see if Senator Shields is out in the hall, that would be wonderful. And we'll just hang tight for a minute before we decide where to go. My hope is to go to Senate Bill 185 just to pass that out, because we were adding the emergency clause. And to those in the audience, the bill that's on our agenda that has the most attention here is Senate Bill 69. I know that some of you came from quite some distance to come and testify, and we will definitely give you an opportunity to do that. We're trying to move through some of the easier bills early so we could leave a chunk of time. So hopefully we'll get to you soon, and I appreciate your patience in that regard. So let's open a work session on Senate Bill 185, and just to refresh the committee, this is the one we've already heard on water right issues, and Senator Beyer thought that it would be appropriate to add an emergency clause, so the dash one is the emergency clause, and I'd like to go ahead and move the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 185. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And then I'd like to move Senate Bill 185 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Do you need a motion, or did you just make that?
I just made the motion.
Okay.
Any objection? So ordered. And who would like to carry this bill?
Carry it.
Okay. Senator Beyer will carry that bill. Thank you. And then let's go ahead and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 66.
Good afternoon, Chairman Ringo. For the record, my name is Tim Wood, Director of the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department, and this is Janet Tyndall is with me. She's the Assistant Director of the Department for Administration. Thank you for the opportunity to comment on bill here, Senate Bill 66. We're asking for your support. This bill would authorize the Parks and Recreation Department to adopt rules that would recognize the federally recognized Indian tribes among the public bodies who are eligible to receive grants from our department. I believe this bill is important under the current statute because currently we only can disperse funds to local governments or other state agencies. By extending this provision to federally recognized tribes. This would allow them to receive monies and benefit from the recreation and the from recreation grant programs that we administer in the department and contribute to outdoor recreation in the state as well as quality of life. My department administers four recreation grants programs that would be affected by this legislation. The first is the local grant program, which is a program of $8 million that's grant funds which are granted to for the purposes of acquisition and development of outdoor park and recreation facilities. We also administer funds through the Land and Water Conservation Fund. It's a federal program, about $1.4 million annually. Also for acquisition and development of outdoor park and recreation facilities. Recreation Trails Program is an $800,000 annual federal grant program for the development of trail systems. And the All-Terrain Vehicle Account, which is about a $6.25 million biennial grant program for acquisition, development, and maintenance of motorized trails. So we're asking for your support for Senate Bill 66 to allow us to include sovereign federally recognized tribes as eligible entities for these grant programs.
Thank you very much. Any questions?
Mr. Byer? Thank you. Do you have or have you in the past had any the federally recognized tribes apply and you've had to turn them down?
Chairman Ringo, Senator Byer, no, we have not at this point.
Follow up. Are you aware of any programs or any applications pending that the tribes may wish to apply for?
Senator Ringo, Mr. Byer, I know of no specific projects. I do know that the tribes the money primarily in the local grant program is provided through the ballot measure 66 or lottery funded measures. I do know that the federal tribes are eligible for grant programs through the other side, the watershed enhancement side of that funding. So this would make it consistent with those two, with the expenditure of Measure 66 funds.
I have a follow-up. So if my, you know, for the Measure 66 funds on the OWEB side, that's for stream enhancement, fish passage, those kind of things, and obviously benefits on tribal lands benefit an entire watershed. But in this case, it's a local government grant. With these funds, if they are applied for, I don't know what the restrictions are, but I would assume their places are open to the public, all the public of the state of Oregon. Right. Would that necessarily have to be the case with the federal tribes?
Chairman Ringo, Senator Byer, they would be available for use of the public just like the grant funds that we provide to other governmental entities are open for use of the general public.
I mean, that's a good question, but just I want to ask the question again. So if there was a project done on tribe lands, the public would be allowed to use the benefit of those funds.
Chair Ringer, that's correct.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, and actually that raises a question in my mind, too. Are tribal lands normally open to the public, or would this cause them to be open to the public if they're one of these grants?
Chair Ringo, Senator Burdick, I know that I can't answer that specific to tribes, but restrictions that would be placed on the use of these funds would require that they be made available for the general public.
That answers my question. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Ed Johnson, we won't forget you this time. Come on up and testify.
Yeah. My name is Ed Johnston, and I have conflicting interest on this bill. It sort of sounds good up front, but the other point is that when we voted Measure 66 in, the state has received hundreds of millions of dollars from lottery funds. And that's a question of why we even pay admission fee to any state park in this region. My question into this is that the casinos already have enough gambling going on, raising their money. Let them take care of their responsibility. It is not the present people today to take... You know, going back into history, my family's been and moved to the state of Oregon in 1792. My family's been here for over 200 years. I can understand some of the process and point. But when it comes down to it, the public should definitely be against this. The tribes get enough federal money in that, and I'm not going against the tribes of saying it's a negative thing. But we can't afford it. When it comes down to it, we can't afford all the pay increases, the PERR programs, and everything else. If we're going to use that money, let's make sure that we bail the state out of the recession and the devastation that people have caused us for this, instead of giving more money and writing more checks out of thin air. We don't have the assets to guarantee these checks that we're going to be issuing. There's no point of writing more checks out of the air. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Mr. Pitt, come on up. I'm sorry, Katie.
Louis Pitt, Jr., Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs. We do have tourism on reservation that very much depends on trying to invite, I think, our neighbors into our reservation. And as Senator Burdick has talked to, is, yes, the treaty lands, the treaty is to be taken very serious. And so we are opening up some doors, not all doors, to invite folks in. It's been very cumbersome. We have a couple of parks that where we did receive some dollars for Dry Creek in the past on the Deschutes River, and it was like pulling teeth to try to get dollars through the process. And so this would, I think, simplify the process. We didn't, it wasn't easy access to dollars to get them right now. We have, as example of places where we'd like to have some improvements, that we would be the High Lakes up on the, at Warm Springs Reservation, the High Lakes, a great number of lakes up there, access only during the summer months. The McQuinn Strip, which is perpetually open to non-Indians, and we still are challenged with some of the costs of maintaining parks and amenities in that area. Kaneda itself is an area that, of course, we'd like to keep open, have to keep open. Tourism is the number one thing there, and would like, again, some dollars to help stiff up those parks there. The Dry Creek Campground, as I mentioned before, right there on the Deschutes River, and real fairly rustic areas that I think upgrading and making them safer is we're always looking for dollars. Our community area, we're always trying to, I think, attract people, again, tourism, onto taking some time off the road to just take a break. And we have a number of other projects that may relate to parks and recreation. Again, we'd be, I think, as Parks and Recreation Director Wood has talked to, is that hopefully this will make the paper trail a lot easier. And, again, we're looking forward to that, and I think honor our sovereignty to work more directly with us, and we sure appreciate that, too. Okay.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions? Okay. I'd like to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 66 and open a work session on Senate Bill 66 and ask for a motion.
Mr. Chair, I'd move SB 66 for the due pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Atkinson has moved Senate Bill 66 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Mr. Johnson, I completely agree. State parks ought to be free, and they ought to be much better funded than they are now. To me, this bill just allows some flexibility that, frankly, will promote public access to some important areas, and so that's why I'm going to support it. Any other discussion from the committee? Is there okay? No further discussion. Is there any objection? Okay. So ordered. Senate Bill 66 passes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Would you like to carry it, Senator Shields? Okay. Thank you very much. Let's open a public hearing on Senate Bill 68. Mr.
Chair, again, for the record, my name is Tim Wood, the Director of the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. I'm here to request your support for Senate Bill 68. This bill contains makes two changes to existing statute.
This is 69. That I passed. It looks like the one you just gave us.
rewind the tape, don't worry.
Mr. Chair, again, this is this Senate bill makes two changes to existing statute. One is really a housekeeping measure and was submitted at the request of a review that was done by the Legislative Council of some of our statutes after the last session. Actually, all it does is it allows us to, it changes, inserts the words state recreation area into our statute, which allows, which is a permitting program that allows the department to issue permits for pipelines, cables, and other conduits across and under the ocean shore and submerged land adjacent to the ocean shore. And it was determined that it's, that the language of the state recreation area was not included in that statute, and it's also impracticable to install pipes, conduits, and lines underneath the ocean shore without doing it under the state recreation area, the ocean shore recreation area. And so it was at the Legislative Council's request that we made the amendment to this bill for that reason. So that is the first statutory change. The second statutory change that this bill would provide, it would provide the department the authority to issue permits to allow all-terrain vehicle operation on the ocean shore for persons with disabilities, for reasons of emergency response and aid, for biologists, wildlife management activities, and for other natural resource workers. Currently, approximately one-third of the 362-mile ocean shore is open to driving, either seasonally or year-round. However, the current statute only allows street-legal vehicles on the ocean shore area. So Senate Bill 68 would allow the department to issue permits for all-terrain vehicles for these specific purposes and needs. The intent of the department and the Parks and Recreation Commission would be to promulgate administrative rules allowing this activity, but restricted only to the areas of the ocean shore that are currently open to driving. I'd be happy to answer your questions.
Yes, I have a quick question. When you're talking about persons with disabilities, what you're really meaning is access? Because that phrase, I understand it for emergency response and aid biologists, wildlife monitors, and other natural resource workers, but is your intent there access?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that's correct. It's to provide them access to areas which would be, which they might not otherwise have access to because of their disability.
Okay, great. Does the committee have any further questions, comments? Senator Fire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Curious to know if state recreation areas are defined anywhere, and if not, what are they?
Mr. Chair, Senator Breyer, yes, they're defined in statute. I don't have the statute with me now, but the area along the ocean shore from the ordinary low tide line to the either the statutory line, which was surveyed in when the ocean shore recreation areas were established, or to the vegetation line, whichever is farthest inward.
So they are just somewhere in the statute, Mr. Chair, if I could clarify. Somewhere in 390, is that what they're defined?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bart, yes, that's correct.
Okay, further questions?
Please proceed.
Thank you. How about individuals with disabilities? How are you going to define that? I know that under the Access for Disabled Hunters law that was passed in, what, 99, I think, originally, or something like that, where there was a few hundred people at first, and now there's thousands or tens of thousands of people who qualify for disabled hunter privileges. What kind of definition are you going to have for that, or are you going to do that somewhere if it just doesn't get out of...
Senator Atkinson, Senator Beyer, we would define that... by the restrictions that are placed, the same rules that are used by the Department of Motor Vehicles in defining disabled vehicle operators.
Follow up. Would these folks then have to then get a disabled, parking permit type something for their ATV?
Mr. Chair, Senator Byer, that's correct. They would apply to the department, and we would validate that their Their disability permit is from DMV and would issue issue them a permit for operating an ATV on the ocean shore.
Okay. One more question.
Sure.
Under Section 4 of the bill, you're deleting a whole bunch of stuff and replacing it with a little bit of stuff, which generally I like when we delete lots of stuff and replace it with a little bit of stuff. But curious to know, it says there under Sub 4 is being deleted, subject to ORS 153.022, violation of any rule adopted under 390.845 is a Class A violation. And I don't see where you're replacing that with anything where other things that you are... I can see where you're replacing the fines not exceeding $500 or imprisonment of 6 months or both down below, but I haven't seen where you're replacing violations of that rule.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Beyer, I can't answer that specifically at this time, but the intent is that this would have to conform with the motor vehicle code, because right now motor vehicles ATVs are not classified as illegal vehicles, and so the intent here is to be sure the two conform. I can't answer that question specifically for you, but I will do that.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions?
Mr. Chairman, I guess I'm unclear. Current law allows these all-terrain vehicles without restriction. Is that it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berg, current law does not allow ATVs on any portion of the ocean shore that's open to driving. And the reason is because the motor vehicle statute only allows vehicles determined to be street legal vehicles, and ATVs are not.
That's correct, and that's because the shores are defined as public highways, and that's how they manage to require that they be open to the public. And I certainly approve of that policy, but I have questions about this. Number one, I don't see anywhere in these requirements that somebody actually has to have a driver's license to drive one of these on the beach.
Mr. Chair, Senator Burry, the requirement to have an operator's permit is a part of the statute we'll be talking about in the next bill. But there is a requirement that ATV, Class 1 ATV operators have an operator's permit.
And that's somewhere else in the law?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burry, that's correct.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, it's just, you know, the whole character of these things is completely different than a car or a pickup. I mean, they can dart in and out. They're much more versatile in terms of weaving in and out. And I just wonder, I mean, there have been problems with conflicts with cars on the beach where cars are allowed. And I'm just wondering whether this would pose a lot more conflicts.
Okay. Committee, I'd like to not move this bill forward because I think there are some significant questions. Now let the department work with the senators that have expressed the questions. I would like to very quickly move on to Senate Bill 69, but I do want to hear from Ed Johnston on this. So let's hear from Mr. Johnston. Then we're going to close this public hearing, and we'll let the good senator from Ashland and his friends testify on Senate Bill 69.
My name is Ed Johnston, and Sheriff Senator Burke, I do have your concerns as well with that. Driving on the coast has always been right for everybody for years. I don't know why we're doing this. And it gets frustrating with an operator's permit or driver's license. This can go against somebody's driver's license, raise their insurance fees or something like that if they get that citation. Operator permits are a privilege to drive if you sign for that privilege. Technically, we don't need a driver's license under federal law because they're issued by the number of drivers. So it can produce a 14- or 15-year-old kid a lot of problems over this, and when they finally decide that they want to sign or relinquish for permission to drive, it could really affect their future. I'm totally against this, totally against it, and I think everybody should be, because the beaches belong to the residents of Oregon, also too. They are in the federal high tide line, so there are federal regulations that possibly might be in violation, too, of this, what they're going on, and I think those need to be considered. We don't need to have more regulation and red tape for using our land. I mean, and that's the frustrating point. Every time we turn around, we're doing regulations on our land. You know, and it's like, when is it going to stop? I mean, next thing you know, we're going to be asking permission to go to the bathroom with a checkout card. So, I mean, we've got, it's not far down the road with some of the things we're doing, especially the sensation of what I've been reading. It's scary. So, I mean, when it comes to this, we need to really consider and not open up our parks so that way we're restricting the public from their constitutional rights and their constitutional freedoms of our land. We're restricting their constitutional rights. And that could possibly end up being a lawsuit down the road and cost the state multi-millions, and I don't think that the state's prepared to do that.
I don't think so either. Well, Mr. Johnson, I think you do have some skeptics on this committee, but we'll see where it all falls out. I appreciate your testimony, and this closes the public hearing on Senate Bill 68. I'd like to notify the audience that we will not be getting to Senate Bill 125 today. The primarily herbivorous piranha bill will have to wait for another day, because now we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 69. And is what I'd like to do on this bill is to let the director come up and give us an introduction of the issue, kind of lay out the landscape for us. And we do have a number of folks signed up. Some of them came from quite a distance, and some of them are not on the positive side of this bill, but I'll let them come up and give the other side of it. So, Mr. Wood, do you want to come forward, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, for the record, my name is Tim Wood, the director of the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department, and I'm here to ask for your support on Senate Bill 69. I provided my testimony earlier when we were talking about Senate Bill 68, and I will summarize it briefly. In summary, this bill would change the terminology regarding off-highway vehicles and clarify the process used to allocate funds dedicated to ensuring managed, safe, and sufficient opportunities for motorized off-highway vehicle recreation. I believe this bill is important to clarify conflicting sections of the code and to make Oregon's terminology consistent with the national trend in reference to this form of recreation, and to broaden citizen representation in the All-Terrain Vehicle Account Allocation Committee, and to make grant administration for this program consistent with other recreation grant programs administered by the department. This program is funded solely by off-highway vehicle recreationalists in two ways: taxes paid on fuel used in off-highway vehicles, and two-year $10 access permits allowing vehicles to use public lands for off-highway recreation. To the first change, the term all-terrain vehicle is generally recognized to encompass only 3- and 4-wheel vehicles used for off-highway recreation. However, recreational motorized trails and dunes commonly include other types of vehicles: motorcycles, sand rails, four-wheel drive vehicles such as Jeeps and SUVs. The more broad-based term, which is now industry standard, is off-highway vehicle, or OHV, and this bill would just replace the term all-terrain vehicle with the term off-highway vehicle. The bill also would remove current conflicts in statute governing administration of the all-terrain vehicle account. Specifically, there is specifically no substantive changes made to the initial clause, but funds to administer and manage the recreation program would continue to be deducted prior to deposit in the all-terrain vehicle account. Section 3 of the bill deletes those clauses that conflict with the opening clause, and the activities that are described are budgeted and paid for from administrative deduction and not included in the all-terrain vehicle account that is further then allocated for acquisition, development, management, and maintenance of and motorized riding areas. Essentially what that does is it takes off the cost of administering the ATV program prior to releasing the rest of the funds for distribution through grant programs. Law enforcement, education, safety training, and emergency services are also paid from this account. Section 4 of the bill seeks to conform the recreation grant program to other recreation grant programs administered by the department. It would change the composition of the All-Terrain Vehicle Account Allocation Committee and the committee's relationship to the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. Currently, the seven-member account allocation committee is composed of six representatives from various off-highway vehicle clubs and one all-terrain vehicle user. However, clubs represent 10% of all off-highway vehicle users, and there's no representation from the public at large. All the other recreation grant programs that are administered by the department have nine members and include representation from the public at large. With the exception of the Recreation Trails Grant Committee, and all other recreation grant committees report to the director and not to the Parks and Recreation Commission. Section 9 of the bill creates a provision so that out-of-state recreationists may purchase access permits for their vehicles in Oregon, even if they have not been issued a permit from their home state. The current statute has been difficult for law enforcement personnel to enforce because failure to have a permit from their home state could result in a violation and a citation with no option for the visitor to comply other than to leave the state. Most out-of-state visitors using Oregon's motorized recreation areas are tourists on vacation. Such limits to visitor recreation opportunities are inconsistent with Oregon's tourism goals, and this bill would correct that problem. Finally, the bill would remove the specific dollar amount for the fees the department may charge people to enroll in department-offered off-highway vehicle safety courses and the fee for the two-year access permit. Without this change, the fees would be capped at $5 and $10, respectively. We're seeking a fee increase in this regard. However, there is a current statute which requires any changes in fees to come before the legislature anyway. So, Oregon's fees are well below neighboring states, and sometime in the future it may become necessary to look at this, but that's not an issue before us at this time. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have, and I thank you for the opportunity to present the support for this bill.
Thank you. Committee, any questions?
Mr. Chair, are you going to allow the folks to testify, and then if no. We have a question?
We're not hearing at all from the SYM. Yeah. Why don't you stick around?
Yes.
And then that way you'll be able to respond to the testimony you're about to hear. Representative Nolan, are you here to testify on this, or just kind of? Okay. Okay. Well, why don't we have the folks who drove the distance to come here, and let's see. Do you live? Let's start with Tyrell Hart, Pat Harris. Is that you, Pat Harris? What's that? Okay. All of you, come on up if you'd like. I don't want to. Go in any particular order you want, but go ahead and identify yourself before you start talking.
My name is Pat Harris, and I belong to a four-wheel group out of Klamath Falls, Oregon, and I currently chair the committee. The ATV account allocation program was established in 1984 by the Oregon legislature to address the needs of the off-highway community. The program was originally administered through ODOT and in 2000 was transferred to OPRD. In 2004, OPRD indicated they were going to submit a legislative concept to the legislator that would clarify housekeeping changes they wanted to the program. There was no prior discussion on the concept. After it had been written by OPRD, it was submitted to the committee for comments. Comments and suggestions offered were not included in the package that is being presented to you. Their changes diminish the ability of the committee to represent their constituents. They want to change the structure of the committee, control how committee members interact with land managers seeking grants, and lengths of terms for those serving on the committee. It appears that they want to slide the off-highway program into the other programs that they control. It clearly states in this summary on SB 69 they seek to change the name and purposes of the ATV Account Allocation Committee. The name change for ATV Account Allocation Committee to Off-Highway Vehicle Account does not bother me. It does bother me when they want to change the purposes of the committee. The ATV program is unique. It is the only program that addresses the needs of the off-highway users and pays for itself. An economic survey performed by Oregon State University in 1999 indicated that off-highway vehicle recreation contributed an estimated $120 million and 1,809 jobs to Oregon's economy. The number of people becoming involved in off-highway recreation continues to grow. Proposed concepts that I find unacceptable are some of the terms they inserted, like project management. We could not get that clearly defined. Resource management was not clearly defined. We have 7 members on the committee. 2 of those represent Class 1, which are your ATVs. 2 represent Class 2, which is your four-wheel drive vehicles and dune buggies. And you have 2 that represent Class 3, which are motorcycle. We also have a member at large. We believe that the committee should remain 7 members, raising it to 9 with the two additional positions appointed by OPRD director could adversely affect the program with people who are not knowledgeable about the off-highway program. We have seen what has happened in both California and Arizona. Class 2 representatives should continue to be 1 from a four-wheel drive group and 1 from a dune buggy group. They are different and they have different needs. Our member at large, we feel, should remain as 1 member. OPRD should continue to provide staff support for the committee and for the expansion of the programs for OHV users. That section was completely removed. The terms of the committee members should be determined by the committee. They are better able to determine if the member is providing the best representation for the constituents they represent. And that's all I have.
Thank you very much. Why don't we go ahead to Mr. Hart? You submitted your written testimony. It says at the end you want us to kill this bill here in our committee right now.
Yes, sir.
Why don't you tell us why?
Okay. My name is Terrell Hart. I live in Medford, Oregon. I've been a member of the ATV Account Allocation Committee for nearly 4 years. Before becoming a member of the committee, I appeared before the committee many times to seek grants for motorized recreation in Southern Oregon. This committee of volunteers has worked very well for 20 years and has some very dedicated members. All of the members are enthusiasts of motorized recreation. When this bill was first introduced to our committee by the State Parks Department, we were told by the staff it was just some bookkeeping and such, as our name hadn't kept up with the current terminology and needed changing. SB 69 is not just bookkeeping. Right off the top, it states that this bill will change the name and purpose of the ATV account. It then says that it will change the number of members and the makeup of those members. It makes the appointment of members the job of the State Parks Director. Our current director may be a big fan of motorized recreation, but someone who is not may replace him. We have seen in California and Arizona the appointment of people who are not only opposed to motorized, but have been unable to gut the funds and disperse the funds to other uses. We now interview prospects that have applied for the openings, and we recommend to the State Parks Commission a name for their approval. I am much more secure in this system than having one person in charge of appointments. This bill will add members to our committee that are not motorized recreationists. When I brought this up to the Park Department director, he said he thought we needed some diversity. Our job is to receive proposals and to recommend the allocation of funds for motorized recreation. Throughout this document, you will notice the addition of phrases such as resource management and program management, followed by including the expenses. As it is now, the expenditures from this constitutionally dedicated fund are recommended by this committee and not drawn from the fund without our knowledge. The director is authorized to shorten the term members who were first appointed to this committee. Does this allow him or her to customize the committee and give him the ability to direct the allocation of funds by people he has appointed? I first appeared here to testify on the first bill to set up this fund in 1971. Took a huge effort from dedicated people all across Oregon, working for many years to finally pass the bill we now work under. I say to you that we have done a great job, and as we are now, and we do not need these sweeping changes that will dilute the purpose and efforts of our committee and our fund. I ask you to kill this bill here in your committee now, and I thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you. Go ahead.
I'll be a little more brief.
Okay. You agree with them?
My name is Scott Ryland. I'm a member of the Northwest Sand Deuces, member of the Oregon Volunteer Dune Patrol, and I'm also, like Terrell and Pat, a member of the Oregon ATV Allocation Committee. Like Terrell stated, when this bill was shown to us in legislative concept, it was described as housekeeping legislation, just minor changes, clean up the wording. And as we dug through it, we found out there were major changes to this housekeeping legislation. It was also stated there was no opposition to this legislation, and we asked who they asked about opposition. And we were given a couple of names, people that I don't even know, and of course they had no opposition. Well, the committee has shown over the last year that we have definite opposition to this, and we feel like we should be heard on it, because we're primary part of this. But I just wanted to state that I am in opposition to this bill, and like Terrell, I would like to see it killed. There's a couple main points to it that bother me that have been spoken on. Other points I could live with, but I don't feel like it could be modified to suit the purposes of the general public, and don't see where it would harm us at this point to kill it. Okay. And therefore, that's why I asked that you do kill it.
Okay. Thank you for testifying, Mr. Ryland. I just have a question. This is probably stated, and I missed it. How much is the amount of money that the fund contains?
Well,
$6.25 million biennially in this biennium.
And that is what we expend. And I'm not sure what's taken out for administration before that, but
okay.
That's one of the things we haven't been totally informed of.
You don't know how much money the fund manages? Oh, you don't know how much is pulled out?
How much pulled out for administration before we get to see it.
Okay, thank you. Other questions from the committee, Senator Atkinson?
Mr. Hart, could you or somebody who's driven up from home explain how the program works with relation to John's Peak at home?
Sure. Prior to my being a member of this committee, the local motorcycle club down there applied to this committee and was given a grant for about $85,000 to create some parking areas at the property that club owns up there. Since then, the club has applied for acquisition funds to purchase additional acreages up Walker Creek, on Jackson Creek, and in that area. We're working with the Bureau of Land Management down there. This fund has members through Bureau of Land Management. Other in Jackson County, Rogue River National Forest has received close to $500,000 over the past few years from this committee. It's been dispersed out for maintenance, development, planning, and safety and education.
Also worked with Boise Cascade.
Yes.
On the peak. And you
have
got
a trail
those
on Boise Cascade that was funded through this.
And you also have those brand new big signs this year. Right?
Big signs.
You know what I'm talking about? Someone's nodding. Right at right by the parking lot. That explain the program.
Certainly, educational signs.
Right, right. The reason I bring that to the committee's attention is twofold. Number one, I ride up there, except I don't have a motor. I pedal. And so I know that project very well, and I also will tell the committee that my brother-in-law, I married Troy Coburn's sister, and I have to make sure that the family gatherings are nice and calm, and he's a member of the something legislative committee on the motorcycle club that manages those funds. So in Southern Oregon, we have a project, this John's Peak project, where there's, no one will tell me straight because no one really knows, but there's supposedly 300 miles of trails up there, and I've ridden up there for 15 years and I couldn't tell you. There's just more trails than ever, but it's managed beautifully. So the project, this, what they're talking about, as the funds are allocated, conservation groups, motorcycle groups get together to maintain erosion and erosion control, it works perfectly. It works better now than it's ever worked. So there's my plug for John's Peak.
Thank you.
And I'm trying to get my brother-in-law's name on the record too. So.
Any other questions from the committee? Thank you very much for testifying. Senator Bates, do you want to come up with the gentleman on your right? While you're on your way, I'd just like to state for the record we've received written testimony from Tim Custer of Salem, and he's not here to testify, but he submitted written testimony in opposition, and I'd just like the record to reflect that. Senator Bates.
I'm Senator Alan Bates. I'm from Southern Oregon, the Senate district next door to Senator Atkinson. I first got involved in this because one of my constituents, Mr. Hart, came to me several months ago and explained what he felt was happening with this bill, and I've had an opportunity since then to have a meeting with Mr. Wood to go over his issues too. My basic feeling, to be really blunt about it, is this: if something's not broken, why try to fix it? And I think this may be a degree what we have going on here. I also like to have, whenever possible, for when we have two opposing groups on a bill to disagree, that they sit down and see if they can work out some language and hit a compromise they both feel comfortable with. And I'm not sure that's been attempted as well as it should have been in this bill either. Having said that, I have a natural concern about a bureaucracy coming in and taking over a program which I think has been run pretty well for 20 years and seems to have actually done a good job for the people it's representing, and from my point of view in my area of the state, done a good job also. I'm not an ATV owner and I don't use ATVs, but I do have a conflict of interest here in that they're a major contributor to my practice. Well, I can always count on a half dozen broken collarbones and broken wrists in the summertime, which are fun to take care of for me, but not much for the people involved. So there is a conflict there. But this is a group that I think is close to the constituency that they're dealing with. And I think this bill would move them away from that and make them less well educated in what this group needs and what this group wants to do. So I'm really thinking, and I'm going to suggest that this bill be tabled this time, that it be worked on in the interim to see if there's some things and some compromise that can be reached, because I think there are some technical changes here that probably do need to be made. But I don't see any great need to pass this bill at this time and to push it on through. So I would ask this committee to table the bill now, look at it in the interim, and then bring it back next session if indeed, in fact, we see a need for a change at that time. But at this point, having listened to both sides, I'm not moved that we need to move this bill forward. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Senator Bates. Committee? Senator Shields?
Senator Bates, you're suggesting moving it to the interim. We've got 4 or 5 months of the session, maybe only 3 months. 4 months, 3, 5, 7. You want to be here for things?
We've only got a couple of weeks, Senator Shields. I'm going to be out of here.
my question is it not possible to get these folks together in the next month or two and try to work some things out?
Having, Mr. Chair and Senator Shields, having talked to both sides in this, I think they're quite a ways apart. And I think that it will be necessary for them to sit and probably have several meetings. And to get people from all over the state together is also a difficulty. These people are from all over the state and represent various groups. I have real questions whether or not they can get that done during this session, and especially with the pressure of the session on board. I would rather see them take some time, be thoughtful and prudent, and if they think there's really a need to bring something forward after those discussions, to do so.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That does clarify. I figured he had a reason to move it all the way to the end.
Mr. Chair, I think these people are a long ways apart right now.
Okay. Sir, do you want to go ahead?
Committee members and Mr. Chair, my name's Arnold Ryland, and I'm sorry I do not have prepared testimony. I've been kind of checking in and out with St. Vincent's Hospital and didn't know whether I'd be here or not. So
I hope you're okay.
And just a couple of things. The young lady that was checked with, when this was sent out and first brought it to attention, it was as an LC concept. And the only contact person was Kelly Taylor, very nice young lady. But supposedly she was the only person that would have any interest in this type of legislation. Where did they have their head? Where were all the off-roaders that should have been contacted? So that was the first minus on the bill. And the only portion of it that I want to address is
I was one of the two people that dreamt up this thing to start with and started this whole program. Larry McCall was the other person. And when this program was transferred over to Parks, I also carried that bill and was questioned quite a bit about, are you sure you want to do this? Well, the users wanted to transfer someplace out of ODOT because there are too many unworkable restrictions over there. Bob Minen and Nancy Rockwell were in charge at that time. Both of them were motorcycle riders. Both of them said, hey, all we want to do is make sure you spend the money legally. It'll be left up to the off-roaders to run this program and tell us how to run it the way it should be. That was great news. So we made all haste and efforts and got moved over to Parks. The ink hadn't even been dry on the signatures to do this when both of them are gone. Since then, there have been one problem after another, minor ones mostly cropping up. But in that change, most of you know Joan Robinson. She's down in your Senate Legal Counsel. I've worked closely with her for almost 20 years. Earl Tarno used to give me a slip to mother and go down and tell her what you want. One thing she wanted to know, I wanted to protect the funds so that it could not be wasted by anybody. She said, what's your purpose? Well, that was it. So she came up with this bit that has been in the law ever since it was passed over here and before that, where the advisory committee is exactly that, whether they want to admit it or not. They're an advisory committee. They do not have final authority to say how the money gets spent, but neither does Parks. It's up to whoever is administering the program to currently spend the money as advised by the committee. They also are supposed to say how much staff support they want. Do they need extra people to accomplish what we want? Are you way over budget or whatever? To be very blunt, I've seen several of the proposed budgets coming up, and having worked with this very closely early on, money-wise and so forth, I'm just appalled at how in the world they can possibly justify a fraction of the expenses that are in there. But I'm not going to go into that. The one thing that I'm dead set against, and Joan advised me on this to watch it, is don't take the paragraph out of there where it's a check and balance system. She figured out the wording personally. And it's in Section 2. I don't have my glasses with me. It's under ORS 390-560. And the entire section with this check and balance is deleted, and it's replaced with basically two words, adding under what money can be used for before it's transferred to the account. It's Parks now would have the authority to deduct for program management. In other words, they could take the money out up front before it ever goes in front of a committee or anybody else for anything they basically feel is worthwhile or not worthwhile or fits their purposes. That was never the intent of this program. If they have something above and beyond what was currently in the legislation that they wanted to spend money for, all they have to do, they figured out the forms that everybody else has to fill out to ask for a grant. They can fill one out themselves, come to the next committee meeting, and ask for a grant for it. If it's a good purpose, chances are they'll get the money and it'll go right on, but everybody will know what's going on, where the money's going. And that's the only reason I've seen total red when I've seen this change is because it eliminates any control whatsoever as far as users say so on where the money is to go.
Thank you. Thank you very much,
time, Mr. Ryland. If I can answer any questions, I'll be happy to.
Well, I appreciate your coming this distance. Are there any questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Thank you, Senator Bates. I'd like to bring up Julie Barrell and Joe Barrell.
That's us.
Is that you? And then I'd like to go back to the department just to hear their response. So, yes, I've got you on the list. I got you list on, but I want to make sure they have time to respond. So.
Didn't sign up to speak. We're just here.
You're not here to speak. Oh, I'm sorry.
No.
We just want to oppose it.
Okay.
We're opposed. I'm on HTV.
You got anything different to add other than everything
heard?
It's just supposed to be a user organization.
Okay. Where are you folks from?
Portland.
Aurora.
Okay, okay. Good. Well, thank you for coming down and sharing your opinion, and it's noted for the record that you oppose Senate Bill 69. Tim, if you could come on up, and you want to come up too. I'd like to hear your response. And I guess particularly for me is that, you know, as Senator Bates put it, if we got a problem, let's fix it. But articulate for us what the problem is that we're trying to fix.
Sure. Senator, Chairman Ringo, members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to. I won't go back and address each of the points that have been made. It's obvious, as Senator Bates pointed out, that there's been some differences between, from the management standpoint, from the department and the account allocation committee. I would just like to say that there has been a significant number of great projects that have been put in place through the ATV program, funded through and approved by the account allocation committee. The Johns Peak one, as well as the Morrow County project, there are lots of good examples out there. And in that regard, that's doing exactly what it should do. Again, the purposes of this bill were to make the administration of the program consistent with the way other programs we manage for distribution of funds to the public agencies and other entities for use of the public. There's large amounts of dollars that are involved here. Our commission feels increasingly more concerned about being sure that not only the dollars in the ATV account allocation committee are used properly, but the other for appropriate purposes and consistently and prudently, the same as it is for the other grant programs that we have in the department.
Mr. Wood, can you point to any specific examples where you think the money was spent inappropriately or somehow the decision-making process was...
Senator Ringo, I can't, and I don't have those examples, and I'm not implying that. All I'm saying is that with the changes we have proposed, the management structure, if you will, around this program would be consistent with the other programs.
Okay, good. Any questions from the committee?
I do Senator have Fields. Senator Ringo, a moment ago you asked Tim if he could find any example of misuse of money. And it is a big amount of money. I mean, so I guess a different kind of question that I have of you, Mr. Chair, or you, Tim, are there other programs in state government where this amount of money is handled by a citizens group? Does this citizens group have the same kind of auditing of what they do that others citizens groups like them might have? I mean, are there any problems there where we're worried about fiduciary responsibility?
Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, I do not know of any. I don't know. Maybe you all. I don't know.
Again, Mr. Chair, I'm not implying it, that the committee itself or the citizens that give of their time are doing anything wrong. I'm just saying you're talking about $6 million. I've been on a lot of committees in my life. But I've never been on a committee that had the responsibility for that much money. And I'm simply saying, do we have all the safeguards in place that we need to have?
I think
maybe we do. I just don't know. I'm just asking.
Yeah. No, I think it's a question worth asking. I tend to go with Senator Bates. If it's not broken, let's not fix it. But okay, good. Well, thank you for coming up and clarifying that. And Mr. Johnson, we'll give you the last word. Is there anybody else who wants to testify on this following Mr. Johnston?
Okay. Johnston, I'm totally opposed to this bill. I'm also to represent the Wayne County Political Action Committee. We want to keep our beaches open for the public at all costs and not at a cost expense. That horrifies me with some of the changes that are going on in this. The one point I would like to address, misappropriated funds would definitely be on the Department of Oregon Department of Park and Recs Department. Once they end up with that type of control, the responsibility would be they would just frequently spend the money. We have already seen that in tons of agencies in this state already. Citizens groups are doing a good enough job. They're responsible. We are your employers. We're their employers. This agency is getting questionable if it should still be in existence by some of their actions and attitudes. I'm very concerned about one thing. Is dealing with putting this permits, they can sit there and start regulating the beaches and shutting it down at any time. That horrifies me right off the bat. And I can speak professionally on that because I would personally go out and make bumper stickers that ODF or Oregon Department of Fish or Oregon Department Park and Recs stole the next Christmas, just like it did with Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. Because when it comes down to it, you got restaurants, hotels, you got an industry down there. Last year, the Oregon Coast suffered over $100 million loss, over $25 to $35 million lost in tax revenue because the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife shut down the Oregon Coast for fishing. Now, Oregon Department of Parks and Recs do something like that. That's the same effect it will have in those communities. We're going to see bankruptcies. We'll see people losing their homes. We'll see homelessness. We'll see kids on the street more because of what the agency is responsible for doing to the citizens.
Mr. Johnston, I think you're a little far afield from this bill. I'm happy to hear you out, okay. but we're right at the end of the hearing, so give us your best shot for another minute.
Okay. Best shot of this is don't pass this. The public does not need it. We don't want it. There's a majority of the public speaking against a public employee, and let the public have the right to have their say and be heard. We are your employers. We're not your customers.
Okay. Thank you very much. Let's close the public hearing on Senate Bill 69. There's a question as to do we want to schedule any of these. We will move the primarily herbivorous piranha bill. That's my favorite bill of the session so far. Senate Bill 125 will be on the agenda for Wednesday. And thank you, committee. That closes the meeting for today.